Good afternoon, everyone. Nice to see you. My name is John Grant. I'm the Dean of Student Development at Northeast Wisconsin Technical College. The areas that represents are mental health counseling, career services, academic advising, disability services, early alert, Title IX, and student conduct and risk work.
Great. And my name is Kelly Casperson. I am the early alert manager at NWTC. So under my kind of duties would be Starfish is mostly the biggest part of my role, which also includes the intake survey and different retention initiatives like our faculty mentoring, a lot of data tracking with coaching and advising. So faculty engagement as well. But anything else in those, you know, we have some questions that we're going to hit on a lot of that. So
yeah, I'll mention that Kelly and I were fortunate to be part of both IPASS 1 and 2 grants with the Gates Foundation, and some of the work that we're going to be talking about this afternoon really was born out of the IPASS work that we were doing, trying to make early alert earlier, basically, both through starting some work in predictive as well as really sort of collecting information earlier from students that we weren't getting in any other way that we thought might be helpful for us to know in terms of creating success plans for them.
So I think what we wanted to start with, it says on here that we wanted to talk a little bit about addressing some technical questions as well as intake in our onboarding process. So I'll start with just kind of an overview of how we're set up and what we use and how we do some of those different processes. So just like the college, I think on here it says PeopleSoft and Starfish. Those are the two systems that we use as well. We also have Blackboard. Those are, and then as a CRM, we use Salesforce. So those are really our four big technology systems at the college. And as, in terms of onboarding, I'll just kind of walk through how we're set up. So we have a recent change with our college is that we have admissions advisors, starting with students from the times that they apply to the college until they come to what we call a SOAR or registration session, which is a mandatory step in our new student process. It's very similar to an orientation. I know I heard that someone was one of our orientation directors here. So probably very similar to what you do. It's a required step for our new students. Once they're admitted to the college, they come to that session to learn more about our services, learn about the college, get a student ID, and actually register for classes at that time. That's also when they take our intake survey. So it is a mandatory step that they come to that session and take that survey. So that's why we do have a really high response rate as far as the number of our new students that take that survey. From that point, we also have a secondary component to our orientation, which is called a welcome week. And that happens the week before the semester starts. So students come back for that right before the semester begins to learn a little bit more about, you know, where to park, get a tour for where their classes are, kind of that just-in-time information. That's also when we present a keynote presentation on growth mindset, which does tie into some of the intake survey, utilizing the resources on campus. And that happens at that welcome week session within, like I said, the week before classes begin. At that point, those are really the two required steps for our new students. We do have something called faculty mentoring that also happens in the first semester for our students. And that's a subset of new students depending on the program. It really depends. Some academic programs do every new student. Some of the bigger programs just don't have the capacity to mentor every student, so they choose a subset of their new students. And the goal of that initiative is really for faculty to start engaging with their students early. So being able to review those intake survey responses with the students, talk with them about their program, make sure they have a right fit, make sure that they kind of know what their plans are going forward. And it is not an advising role. It is truly a mentorship role with that faculty member because we do also have assigned academic advisors, which I know you guys call counselors in California. But our advisors are assigned as well. So a student would have an assigned advisor as well as this faculty mentor. So it's not that the faculty does that advising or registration component. That's really an advisor role. And did I miss anything as far as a general overview of how it's laid out, kind of that timeline?
Like Kelly said, maybe the biggest thing to take from that is we really split the onboarding into two pieces. And the upfront new student registration is really just those things that they know or need to know to get into classes and finance their education. And that's where we implement the intake survey. And then welcome week happens the week before school. And that's really about meeting their instructors, really going over some program expectations and getting familiar with the space. And sometimes even getting engaged in activities already on that first welcome week day.
I do have a question. When you do the survey, and thank you for sharing your intake form, you called it a survey. Is it something that students complete in paper format, or do you distribute it electronically somehow? How do you deliver the intake to the students?
Yeah, we can definitely get into some of the technical stuff now. I purposely didn't say that yet, but we totally can. So we've done it a couple of different ways. It's currently in Starfish. So we currently use Starfish to implement the survey and then do the reach outs after that, which I can talk through that process as well. But prior to having the survey available in Starfish, it's a newer functionality for the system. And before they had that ready, we actually used SurveyMonkey. So it was just a regular SurveyMonkey that we embedded into a Blackboard kind of course that students would log into and take right within Blackboard. I will say that the Starfish, using it in Starfish is an extra step for the students because they have to log in and kind of click in a couple places to get to it. Whereas in Blackboard, it was just there and it didn't feel like an extra login because they were already using Blackboard during that session. That I would say is the one downside of having it in Starfish is just that it takes an extra click or two for students to get to it. But that's not a downside by any means for the amount of time it saved us and the efficiency and just for everybody being able to see the results of the survey. Having it in Starfish is leaps and bounds above having it as a separate survey.
So when you have your SOAR event, we have something similar. We call it Discover Palomar. So you bring your students in for that like pre-admission kind of work, for admission work. Do you have them in a lab? Like, do you have everybody in the room and you explain that now we're going to do this intake survey?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so they're physically on campus when you administer
Correct.
The survey. If somebody doesn't attend, are you able to push it out to them or have some follow-up process for them to complete the survey?
They are not supposed to be enrolling in classes if they don't attend. So at this point, we don't really have a really formalized online, and we're working on an online section of it. So in the online section of it, we will give them the step how to log in and how to take it. They'll still be part of that online session. Right now, though, we are filtering through, and this is a relatively new setup for us as far as having this required in person, but we will have it as part of the online once we get that all set up as well.
And when you have them in the lab and you have them do the survey, generally how long does it take them to complete the steps to respond? 5 minutes, 15 minutes?
2 minutes. 2 minutes, 3 minutes, it's short.
Okay. So you can talk technical later. I just wanted to picture at what point you engage the student in telling them.
Yeah, so the way it happens, I'll kind of, the way that that day works, is that they all join in one big room and we do a presentation about, you know, resources. We go through a financial plan, kind of what financial aid is. And then each advisor, academic advisor, takes their group of students to a computer lab or just a room that has laptops, either one. And in that room is where they'll do the intake survey right before they start enrolling in classes, because our students enroll right on the computer, obviously. So they're doing intake survey and enrollment with their advisor in smaller groups. So the advisor is able to introduce the survey a little bit, tell them about why they're answering the questions, what we do with the information. I mean, it literally takes them maybe 3 minutes. It's a really short step.
Quick question. When is this week open again?
A week before school starts.
No, that's the welcome week. This one happens as soon as registration opens. So for right now, for our January students that are starting in January, we started in October. For fall students, we actually start this process in April.
Okay. So we have equivalent events. So we're trying to, you know,
translate
what you call them to what we call them so we can try and figure out if we can repurpose some of our time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you.
John, did you have something to add? Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say part of the reason why we do it during the new student registration process is to give staff the opportunity to connect with students prior to school starting. And if you're anything like us, we continue to admit students all the way up until, you know, sort of that first week of class, if you will, which of course makes this process a little bit harder. So Kelly will probably talk about that a little bit.
I will. Yeah.
And the reason we do that is we want to continue to have opportunities to connect with students. If for some reason we couldn't reach them over the late spring and summer, maybe they're just not thinking about college yet. But in any case, then they get to class and we have an opportunity in the first few weeks to reach out to them, or if they were admitted late. And then we close those referrals and we let the real-time Starfish system of early alert and what's going on in their classes currently sort of take over priority.
Mm-hmm. Quick question, one more. SOAR, it takes place in April. Are students able to enroll in April for fall classes?
Yes, and summer.
Mm-hmm. Now is June, okay.
Yeah, SOAR time is a little different.
And it'll go all, it goes weekly all the way through the summer. So SOAR, it just keeps happening. Once April hits, it'll just keep, every week we'll have new sessions. So, So I can get into some of the workflow as far as what happens when a student takes the survey, some of the more technical stuff, if you'd like, and alluded to some of it, and you've asked some questions about it already. So the student takes the survey at their SOAR session, and then I'm the one who then looks at those results and will send out Starfish referrals to service teams here on campus in batches. So it kind of depends on the SOAR schedule, but if we have a bunch of SOAR sessions in 1 week, I'll wait till after those. So it might be every week, it might be every 2 or 3 weeks, but I will go in time frames of chunks of time and look at the students who took the survey in those 2 or 3 weeks. I will then filter the results, which Starfish, this is one of the huge benefits of moving the survey into Starfish, is that it's literally just a one-click filter, and then I have my list of, here's the 35 students who said they were unsure about their career or program choice. I select all, and I send a referral out to Career Services that says, here's the 35 students that indicated that they're not sure about their career. Please reach out to them within the next, 24 to 48 hours. And then we keep that process going. Teams each handle their referrals a little bit differently. So some teams will send they might send a mass text to that group of 35, or they might send a mass email to that group. Some may call them individually first. Some may do the call individually second. So it really depends on the team's staffing and kind of how they want to work those referrals. But essentially, teams are responsible to reach out to those students at least 2 times to try to get in touch with them prior to the semester starting, or at least within the first couple weeks of the semester, to have that conversation about, here's what you said on your intake survey. First, I want to let you know I'm a resource for you. Welcome them to campus. They can thank them for enrolling. And then really get into some of those responses that they mentioned on the intake survey. Now, students currently are not informed that they have this referral out there until a staff member makes a connection with them. So I know normally in Starfish, if you're using it currently, students get notified if they have a flag or referral. These referrals are behind the scenes, whereas only staff are notified that they're out there. We did that because we didn't want students probably aren't checking their email before the semester starts. They might be confused about what it is, why they're getting this email from Starfish. But secondly, we didn't want an email to really be the first. We wanted staff to be able to kind of control what they were saying to students and to make it more of a welcoming, coaching type of conversation with those students, rather than just a blanket email that says, hey, you told us some things that might be barriers for your success. Let's talk about those. So we've switched it so that students aren't notified and staff kind of controls those notifications to their students. I'll repeat that process every couple weeks until the semester begins. So I'll keep batching those referrals, sending them out to the different teams, and teams just keep on calling and reaching out to those students all the way, like John said, through about week 4 of the semester. And then we just kind of clear them in bulk and say, okay, these students never responded. They never got back to us. Does that make sense? Questions about that process?
One question, are students required? Did you say students are required to complete the SOAR?
They are.
And so, if so, what do you do with students who are completely online, like say active duty people? How do you handle that?
John might need to answer that one. I know the process has changed.
Yeah, so just for this particular semester start, we've developed a new online orientation for our students. And so we had a couple of advisors actually build that, sort of an adaptive release type of quiz structure within Blackboard with the content, and students then essentially having to engage in it and demonstrate that they have completed the sections. And then that triggers our admission staff to take a hold off of their registration once they complete the SOAR.
Thank you.
Can you also talk about what happens if a student doesn't answer? I know you said at week 4 is sort of the amount of time that you give the teams to respond, but what sort of process have you set, and is it different on the area that you refer students to?
Yeah, each service team is able to really design what happens. Essentially, there is no repercussions if a student doesn't get back to us. It's their choice if they want to respond to those referrals or not. What we do is typically, it's mostly right now for data purposes. So we track the students who responded. How much more likely are they to be successful in their classes, persist? And that's kind of one of the factors we use in our data pretty frequently is, of the students who responded, do they do better than the students who never responded? Other than that, teams may do something, but it's not something that's documented, and I wouldn't know kind of what each team is doing for that group.
And can I also ask how early you introduce Starfish to the new students?
it'll be at that SOAR. So when they come to register for classes, they'll hear just a tiny snippet about what Starfish is, basically just to say that you can take your intake survey in it and that there's services and you have like a success network. That's what they learn at SOAR. It's a very, very basic. And then at Welcome Week, we get into it a little bit more, but still not a ton. We don't have a great Starfish training for students yet. We're hoping to get there. That's really one of our goals for this upcoming year, is to get students more engaged in the system. We've had Starfish for now 5.5 years, and students is really kind of our one area that we need to work on, is getting the students trained and using it more frequently.
So we're using Starfish for faculty members to give referrals. We're testing the feature where students can self-refer right now and raise their hand. But when you bring your students into SOAR, what is the relationship you set up? Not an instructor-student relationship. Is it some kind of umbrella relationship that you can, what format do you push the survey out to them in? How do you get them all eligible to take the survey?
It's either an on and off for the survey. So you either make it viewable or not viewable, and then anyone who's in Starfish can see it. It'll be like under the student's profile where they can like change their email address. There's a little tab that says intake once you make it available. So you don't need any type of relationships. Now to see the results, that's where the relationships come in. You have to, it's role-based security based on who can see the results of the survey. Now I will say that our campus is very different when it comes to Starfish security. We let every faculty member that's full-time, every staff member that works with students, which is pretty much everybody, see every student. Instructors can see not just their own class, they can see all of the tens of thousands of students that are in Starfish. We made that choice very early on based on feedback from our faculty and from our students, that they wanted to just be able to see a more holistic view of the students and be more engaged in the student's entire career rather than just what they're doing in their class. So we do keep a very open security setup in Starfish.
Huh. We'd have to talk about that later.
And you already resolved any FERPA issues, right?
Correct. All of our staff are trained on FERPA.
Yeah, we actually couple up the FERPA training with the Starfish training. It might be helpful to know, too, that just to back this process up a bit, when Kelly and I first started working on this, we brought a team together from across the college to include folks from our learning departments, from IT, from the library, from recruitment, from a number of different services, and started sort of working through the process of what we wanted to know about students. And there were a number of tools that were available in the marketplace, but they were long and they were expensive. And one of the things that really drove the work that we wanted to do is that we didn't want it to feel like a barrier in their registration process. And so we decided to create our own in-house survey based on what we sort of knew to be issues for students just based on our experience. And as you can imagine, lots of people wanted a piece of that. They all wanted their questions.
They still do.
We started off with probably a pool of 40 to 50. And we're able to get it down to about 15. In that process, we really backtracked it from the services that we already had available. So for example, we have a mental health counseling team. And we would pose the question to the mental health counseling team, if you could know something about a student prior to them ever enrolling here that might help you support them from a counseling perspective, what would that be and what would you do with it? And then those teams helped us design the questions that referred to their service. And then those teams were also empowered to be part of the design of the intervention. So we're going to give you this list of students who say that they have a mental or emotional health need that they might want support with. What do you want to do with that? And it was a really good opportunity and exercise, I think, to work through with each of the teams to really think about how we might handle this more proactively than when a student's in week 7 and they failed 2 classes and all of a sudden it's crisis time or there's something going on in their personal life. They were able to come in and build relationships potentially with some of our, you know, counselors early or our disability staff or our advisors based on responses they had given that allowed us to have a plan in place and then a relationship built for when things got tougher.
If you could just say a little bit more about building the survey over time, because I know we're at least iteration 3, if not more, I'm sure. And, I love the fact that the people who will actually use the data help to contribute to the questions. And so if you could just talk about how you involve people and the crafting of questions, because some of it is quite sensitive. And I was really impressed how you managed to get at
some difficult issues that students may face in a way that seems really non-invasive and respectful and so forth.
Yeah, so I guess I'll start, and Kelly, feel free to jump in, but one of the things that was really important to us is that we framed the survey in a way that, I guess, sort of nudge students to complete the survey in the first place. And so, you know, we give them a little bit of information about successful student behaviors and reaching out, really, you know, acknowledging, I guess, an area of need, and then hopefully reaching out and following up for support. And then you'll notice that we close the survey with a question that's really, there's another open-ended question in here, which has to do with their primary language, but it's really the final question that we see a lot more of open text responses in, and that was really the intent, was to have them finish on sort of a very growth mindset, positive, motivational type sense of their experience coming to college, rather than to focus too heavily on where they might have identified barriers for themselves through this process. And so I don't know that that's perfect, but that was sort of the intent, was to have them leave this experience feeling a little bit more positive. The questions themselves have really been, it's been a work in progress. And I will say, from the first time we offered it, some questions have changed significantly. Some look very similar. We're on probably the third or fourth edition of this. And honestly, I will tell you where some of the issues came in is we realized that with all best intentions, we asked some questions that were double-barreled, that were probably confusing to a student. We asked some questions where the question didn't exactly line up as well as it probably could have with the responses. And so those are just a couple of examples, but wording, of course, was really important. So one of the things that we did early on, we shared this with a number of people around the college to get feedback, and then we also took the survey into our Dev Ed classes. And we had a few instructors and advisors share this with students to just get feedback about what's it like to take the survey? Does it make sense to you? Do you understand what we might be asking here? And just getting some early feedback that helped to support the way the questions were being asked. And then we got some help from both Hobson's and from an organization called the Rux Group that does evaluation work. And we spent the better part of an 8-hour day poring over every word of every question in here with help from them in terms of making sure that we were asking the best questions for evaluation, making sure we provided enough granularity in the responses, enough gradients, I guess. And that was a really helpful experience. And then we continued to modify things a little bit. So for example, this current semester right now that we're preparing for and we're registering students in spring, we've added two questions, one around housing insecurity and one around food insecurity. As those were gaps for us that we identified, you know, fairly quickly as we were learning more about our students and the amount of poverty that existed. So that's a little bit about how we got here. I will say one of the things that's probably overlooked in this process is, you know, you design these questions with the teams, they give you feedback about how they want to respond, and you build the responses, and then you get the responses back from the students, take the survey, and all of a sudden you have data, and you have to make some decisions about things like, okay, if a student said their past experience in math was slightly challenging, are we going to respond to that? Or is it only if it's moderately challenging and very challenging? And so part of it was really, in the beginning, looking at the amount of response we had to particular answers, and then sort of going through each of those and assigning referrals based on capacity in the teams they were going to. So if that makes sense, we didn't want to send 600 referrals if we could avoid it to financial aid with a team of 4 people or 5 advisors. So that was also part of just this experience, is trying to figure out, like, where's the threshold that's manageable, that's still having an impact. And I think we've gotten better at asking some of these questions, but the other thing I'll say is that one of the things that Kelly and I have done a lot when we present on this topic is we do this exercise where schools will tell us, you know, a little bit of the information they'd love to know about their students. And when we have them actually write a question for themselves and their institution as part of one of the activities. And it's a great opportunity for us to hear really creative ideas and good suggestions for things that we can consider to build into our survey as well. So we tell everybody, you can borrow our survey, you can use what works for you and toss the rest. And That's part of the idea, I guess, is that hopefully we all get better at doing this together, and that hopefully we can still, you know, collect ideas from other institutions too.
I would say too, a couple of things to add is really the question that was probably the most difficult for us and still probably poses the most struggle with how we respond to it is the financial question. I think right now we have it settled to how do you plan to pay for college and just give them various choices. That has been worded different, I feel like, almost every semester. And that it's just a challenging question for us because, first and foremost, students don't have to pay until the semester starts. And sometimes they're taking this, you know, 6 months in advance. So that makes it hard in one way. It also, there's just so many responses to it, and not all of them need someone to reach out to them. We landed on for this semester, and I actually just used these referrals today. So right now with that question, the only two responses that get a referral right away are, I'm unsure how I'm going to pay for college. That is our biggest one. If the student says unsure, it goes to our financial coach, a grant-funded financial coach. The second group that we look at are students who say they're planning to pay with financial aid, and then I match that up. This is the only question that I pull out of Starfish and do in Excel, is I match it up with who we have a financial aid, a FAFSA on file for. I pull that out of PeopleSoft, match those two up, and only raise referrals for students who said financial aid, but we don't have a FAFSA. So that's the only group that I do a little bit of manipulation to those results. And we used to do that a lot more when we had the survey and SurveyMonkey. We would combine a lot of things and had a whole hierarchy of, it would take weeks to sort through the data to get any referrals out. And now literally I just did it in the 10 minutes before we had a phone call today. So it's gotten a lot easier, and that's the one group that I would say is still challenging, and they still get hundreds of referrals and there's four of them. So it's still a difficult group for us to wrap our arms around. I'll also say that I think what makes this process an important part of it is having someone that can hold all the teams accountable. So right now that's kind of my role, is to weekly send out updates about, okay, here's how many referrals are open. Financial aid, you have zero closed. Like, let's get some work on. Do you need help? Do you need advisors to help you? Do you need career services to help? Because maybe they don't have as many referrals. So it's really having kind of that accountability that teams can come back to. We didn't do that for fall. I will say that I didn't do as many weekly updates, and we saw our response rate to the referrals drop dramatically because we didn't have someone kind of pushing it along and making it a priority for everybody. We kind of felt like it was woven into what they did in their everyday work, but maybe not. So we're going back this semester to now having this weekly update about, here's how many are open, here's how many are closed, here's kind of a weekly update about what's happening. That seemed to work better, so we're going to go back to that now for the spring and see if it increases our response rate.
Yeah, I think once you ask some of these questions, I believe you take on a responsibility to respond with some of this information that you become aware of. And so Kelly's right. I mean, keeping the momentum up, especially at a time that for student services tends to be the busiest of the year, can be challenging. But I think we try to sell it on the fact that these are opportunities to avoid larger issues later, if we can be more proactive. And the other thing I'll just say about the questions, and then we can stop talking for a bit. But if you look, I'm not sure which version of the survey you have, but one of the things that we had to make an adjustment for was when we moved the survey from SurveyMonkey into Starfish, we lost the ability to really make referrals confidential in a sense. And I don't know if I'm going to do a great job explaining this, but in SurveyMonkey, we could manipulate the data, create groups of students, and send referrals about private type of things like mental health and disability that other services wouldn't see. When you move the survey into Starfish, it provides you the ability to upload all the information is uploaded into a student folder immediately, which is amazing. And people have access to it and they can filter it, but you can't, it's either on or off. You can't hide questions or put security on questions. So we had to change what we ask about mental health. We had to change what we ask about disability. And now we ask those as, you know, if you'd like more information on those, which to me, it's a bit of a loss because when we ask the mental health question as an example, and I tell this to everybody we talk to, we had 20% of our students saying they had a mental health or emotional behavioral health issue they wanted support with in college. And then we had another 5% who said they didn't want to respond to that question. So we knew that students, A, were being really transparent and honest because that seemed to jive with sort of the norms, I think, across college campuses. But we also knew that we likely had 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 students struggling with mental health. And I liked the fact that we had a more direct question that could help us support those students prior to getting here. So what questions do you have about all of that?
Is that specifically because your campus has chosen to make Starfish very open?
It's just the way that the intake survey is set up. Like I said, the way that Starfish built the intake survey, it's either on or off. So you can't say, I want it on, but I don't want anyone to see the counseling question. You can't pick and choose security based on questions. It's either the whole survey or none of the survey. And with counseling, the mental health question specifically, we didn't want anyone to see it except for the counselors. And the survey, the way it's built in Starfish right now, doesn't allow for that. I will tell you that I think every time I talk, and John and I talk to folks at Hobson's, we mention this. So I think they're sick of us asking for it, and maybe they'll do it soon, is my hope. But
great.
I do have a question about the referrals and sort of the responses that you've gotten. Why, in addition to the referral mechanism, is there anything that you have changed about the way that you offer those services to students that has changed as a result of what you learned from the referral?
Ooh, that's a good question.
I don't know necessarily that it's changed, but it maybe has reinforced a level of demand for certain services. I think it also is going to help illuminate some things for us. So, for example, the housing and food insecurity questions, we really don't know anything about that. Unless a student comes forward and is seeking emergency funding or something like that from our financial wellness area, we really don't know a whole lot about that other than which students are qualifying for Pell, for example. So it has the potential, I think, to tell us a lot more about not only the services we have, but maybe the services that we need. It's a really good question because when we first designed the survey, one of the ways we were able to get down from 50 questions to about 15 is that we really worked with either services we had in place or questions that we thought would be valuable to a coaching or mentoring type conversation when you're meeting with a student one-on-one. With, I think, the full intent that over time we would continue to grow the question database just a little bit, both from a predictive standpoint as well as being able to start partnering up some of these variables and seeing where there might be some significant overlap for students when they're entering the institution. But it'll be really interesting, I think, to see, you know, where there might be opportunities for us to be asking about other things that right now we don't provide support for. And I think the housing and food insecurity questions, we do provide support for those things right now, but I don't think we have a good sense for how much need is there. And so that will be helpful.
Yeah. The other thing I'll note that we don't think we mentioned yet was we were very careful not to ask any questions that we get the answer to somewhere else. So if it's a question that we can get the answer to off of their application or in PeopleSoft somewhere, or they may be answered on their FAFSA somewhere, we're not asking that again. We don't want students to feel like this is a duplication by any means. We also, anytime someone asks us to add a question, which happens a couple times every semester, I would say, because people know it's a really easy way to get to all students, right? So they're like, can I get my question in there? We usually always kind of bring it to our first team that built the survey and really talk through, like, what would you do with this information? You want to ask this question, what do you want to do with it? Does it apply to all students, or is it for your maybe niche grant or your small intervention that you're doing with 20 students? That's not really the type of questions we want to have on the intake survey. So there's been times where we've had to tell people no, and we've helped them, and it's really my role to help them figure out, where else can we get this information? How else can we get at this? Or maybe we can word it in a different way that maybe we can help you get some of what you're looking for. So it has been kind of a, you have to get your question vetted kind of thing, because we don't want it to get to be a giant survey that takes students a long time to complete, or that we're not doing something with the answer. We don't want questions on there that we're not going to do anything with.
Kelly, can you give me an example of what type of intervention you might implement around a student who says they're working 40 plus hours per week while enrolled in classes?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Not all of our questions have direct interventions. So I say that we want to use it for something, but that question specifically, it really depends. What we used to do with that question is combine it with how many credits they were taking. So if they said 40 hours a week and they were taking 15 or more credits, we'd refer them to advising. An advisor would call them and just talk through time management and make sure, you know, talk about their schedule. We no longer do that now that it's in Starfish. So that question is basically just for information, so that when a staff member goes in to call the student maybe about a different question, they're reviewing that behind the scenes and saying, ooh, you know, it looks like John is enrolled in 12 credits and he's working 40 hours a week. I should make sure I talk about that when I call them. So it's really used more now as a case-by-case basis, not as a general referral. But you could, like I said, we used to do it that way. It just took a lot more sorting, and it took a lot longer for me to get the referrals out when I was combining data pieces like that. Same thing with the subjects. So we have the four questions on there about math, science, reading, and writing. When we had the survey and SurveyMonkey, another piece of data combination we did was we looked at if they said that the subject was either the bottom two, so very challenging or moderately, I don't remember what they were, but they said this subject was challenging and they were enrolled in that subject, then we did a referral to academic coaching or tutoring. Now, again, that took a lot more data manipulation behind the scenes, so we no longer do that. Now coaching just waits until the semester gets closer to the beginning and sends out more of a general, hey, did you know we have a math lab and here are the hours? And it's more of a marketing piece than it is a referral for those questions. But again, in there for more of a case by case, I'm working with the student in a mentoring or a coaching relationship, and they said that math is challenging. Let's talk about this.
Yeah, I think one of the things we're hoping is that staff will review the responses before a faculty mentoring meeting or an advising session, so that if a faculty member sees a student is struggling, it might be really helpful for them to know that English isn't their first language or they don't have access to the internet, or maybe they're caring for people in their home besides themselves. Those are opportunities, I think, to have a conversation that might not get approached without some of that prompting. And I think from the same perspective, we would look at it that way in student services. You know, it just gives you a little bit better sense of what a student's world looks like when they're coming to you at your institution and just how much support they may need and what they're trying to balance while going to school.
I have a question. Do students have access to the survey after the onboarding experience, meaning that when they come onto the campus, they are at a place in their life where it's maybe they are really certain they want to be whatever career they choose, or they're feeling very confident about the program that they chose. But as they enter the classes, they start getting a little bit challenged and they feel, oh, I don't know if this is right for me, or I'm not certain that I made the right choice. Do they have an opportunity to go back and revisit, or is that when the interaction with someone happens and that gets addressed?
Yes and no. Technically, the functionality is open, so the students can go back in and change their answer. That's not something that I can turn off in Starfish. So they can go in and edit their survey at any time. Now, the problem with that and why I say no is that I don't know that they do that, so I don't then go in and send out a referral. So I only do the referrals based on when the new students are coming in and registering in those chunks, like I said. So if a student comes in September and changes their answer about math, they're not going to get a referral because I don't know that they changed their answer about math. And they're no longer in that new student group that I would catch them. So that is another challenge with the surveys, that it is editable. We don't have a great way to catch that right now. Ideally, what would happen in that situation is real Starfish would take over, and the student, instead of putting it on their intake survey, would get a referral to coaching in our regular Starfish system, not based on the intake survey. So ideally, that's what would be happening. But I can't promise you that students aren't going in there and changing their answers.
There's not a timestamp or some.
There is a timestamp. There's a last updated date. It just gets really messy, as you can imagine. It's really focused on the new students. So currently, I mean, our business practice doesn't really support catching those students, although it could if we changed it.
You mentioned earlier, Kelly, that you do pull out information about FAFSA from PeopleSoft and that you pull out the responses. So you're able to dump out the data from the intake into an Excel look, and does the timestamp come with it?
It does, yes. There's a created on date, and then there's a last updated date. So it'll give you the first date that they took it, and then if they updated it. So if there's a difference in those dates, you'd know that they updated it. But as you can, I mean, every semester we have 2,500 students come through for the fall, take the survey. So it's just a lot of survey rows to look through and sort through.
Have you, I know this is an intake form, but have you explored using the same intake form, but, you know, maybe rather than just leaving it open, like doing a whole other intake form, but later in there?
Yeah, we would love to. It doesn't allow for that. So Starfish has one intake form. You can only have one active at any time. And if you change a question, the history goes with it. So it's a little bit touchy currently. Like I said, it's a newer functionality for them. So I have a feeling these things are coming. It's just pretty new in its usage in Starfish. So right now, one survey, one set of questions. That's all we get. But yes, ideally, we'd like to ask another one, maybe in semester two or semester three, maybe with some different types of questions, because we know that students have different issues as they continue on. But right now, it just isn't set up for that.
John, this might be a little off track, but can you, maybe you or Kelly, explain a little bit about the mentoring process? Is it mandatory for all the faculty? How do you match people up? How do you sustain that system? I mean, this sounds like it could be thousands and thousands of students.
Yeah, so it is required of faculty by their leadership. And so basically what they do is, and Kelly, I think, referred a little bit to this in the beginning, but it sort of depends on the program team, and they'll identify first semester students and the number that they're going to reach out to, and then they'll assign those to different faculty members who then go into the Starfish system and create a faculty mentoring to-do. And that gets sent to the student, and it allows us then also to measure the amount of contact, basically, that faculty are having with students as they clear those to-do items once they've had the meeting. The expectation really is just for, at this time, full-time faculty, not necessarily our part-time. And I would say that, I want to say they've probably had contact with somewhere between maybe 60 and 70% of their students, just off the top of my head, last semester. We basically can measure how many there are based on the number of to-dos that get raised. And, of course, there are students who just choose not to engage in that practice. But we really have been, I think, trying to encourage faculty to meet with students even earlier than when we first designed mentoring, which was really to happen around weeks, you know, five, six, seven, understanding that a student might be gone by then. And if we don't have an opportunity to start building some relationships maybe earlier in the term in weeks two and three, for example, we might be missing some students that really could have benefited from making a connection and just checking in with someone. You know, you had mentioned earlier, someone asked a question about, what if I get a few weeks in and I realize maybe this isn't the field for me? That's a great faculty mentoring conversation to have. So the sooner the better, I guess, as far as that's concerned. I will also add that one of the things we've been working on here is a coaching framework for all of our student services to work from. So we've been working with a company called InsideTrack to develop, I guess, our case management skills and really get better at being more transparent with students, normalizing their situations, you know, sort of featuring a growth mindset and helping students understand what that means, reinforcing positive help-seeking behaviors, and really starting to do better jobs at framing situations, assessing, and so forth. This is all part of the coaching training. And we've now made that available to faculty, and we call it tips and tricks for faculty mentoring, but it's really coaching principles so that they have more support of the how to do mentoring versus the what. We were pretty good about telling them the what. When we started the process, and they didn't get a lot of support for the how. And so that's been really well received. And I think probably in the next 4 weeks, we're going to see our VP for Learning require it for all of our faculty that do mentoring to go through coaching training.
Quick question, John. Do the faculty receive any kind of compensation to be a mentor?
They do not. It's part of their expected load, I guess you could say.
We have to mention, too, we are not unionized, so that makes a difference.
How many would typically one faculty member mentor?
They usually try to cap it around 20 or 25. Some teams have more, though. I mean, if it's a one-member faculty team and they feel like they want to do their whole new student group, they might have 40 or 50. But I would say that that's very rare. I would say they usually stick around the 20 mark.
Do you attempt to align the faculty with the student interests, like biology with biology and, you know, literature with literature?
Yeah, all of our students who this is for are in an academic program. So they've already selected a degree, and it's a full-time faculty member for that degree.
Great.
So, yeah. We did try it, I will say. We tried it with our students who are we call it a general studies transfer. So they're really just here for a year and then to transfer onto a four-year. That did not go as well because the students didn't really have that connection with the faculty. So they got a lower response rate. And I think they're still working through some kinks to figure out how that team will work with the general studies transfer students, but we do not have a two-year transfer degree like an AAS. It's just those students who come here for a year, so it's a little bit different of a group.
Hi, or John, did you have any trouble enlisting the faculty's willingness to do this? Mm-hmm. They seem to be doing it.
So yeah, I mean,
is there a ramp-up period or?
I would say it's like anything else. There's probably some pockets of resistance. There's other teams that were early adopters. In fact, the reason that this went widespread is that we had some faculty teams already doing it and seeing some really good results from a persistence perspective. And so it was easier to make the case, I think, across the academic departments that this is something that they should try to do. And I would say for the most part, it goes over fairly well. It's always easier for the cohorted programs. It's a little bit tougher in areas like business where you might have two primary full-time instructors in business management, but you've got 150 new students and there's a lot of part-time instructors. So there's just sort of this balance and this give and take in areas, and not every student has the opportunity then to have a mentor. And that's why when we start our academic terms and we go through our in-service process, our faculty teams have essentially a student success data day. And they dig into the data relative to their programs and really try to figure out, you know, where are the gaps and what are things we could be addressing as faculty to support student success. And that's one of the conversations really they're having, is who is the group that we should be focusing on in terms of faculty mentoring if we don't have resources for everyone.
So we piloted faculty advising on our campus. It was not without controversy, but we made it voluntary, and we had 20 to 25 faculty members for each semester, and probably close to 100, 150 students that participated. It was all voluntary for the students. And the same thing, we paired students by major to faculty in that major. So it actually, the offer to students went out based on which faculty had agreed to participate, right? So if we had a lot of math professors, we solicited a lot of math students to engage in that faculty advising session. We did have to pay the faculty to participate, but same thing, the early adopters were all over it. What made it challenging is that we didn't have a tool to do that. I was going crazy with Microsoft Access and pulling data from PeopleSoft and trying to navigate appointments. So I personally found it very challenging because I didn't have the tools. But Starfish, in the way that you use it with the faculty mentoring to do, is something I would love to revisit maybe in another conversation, because that solves my problem of having to do everything in Microsoft Access.
Yes, it's so much easier. And we've added some elements into Starfish now too that can make that, like John was talking about, that data day. We've added some filters into Starfish that are called attributes. So if you're in Starfish, it's an attribute that they can actually, faculty can go in and with a couple of clicks sort for who are all my new students for the fall 2018 semester that had a high school GPA less than 2.5 and are on financial aid warning or whatever. We added a bunch of factors in there that they could really slice and dice without having to run a bunch of PeopleSoft queries and dump it into Excel and, you know, all of that. Because we did that for a long time too. So Starfish does make it way, way easier to do some of that.
How did you do your, I love this idea, student success data day. How do you do that with faculty? Do you provide them a tool where they're looking at, like, do you give them a data set or do they use Starfish or PeopleSoft? Like, what?
Yeah, I think each team does it a little bit differently. I think a lot of them use, we have like a data warehouse. We call it Edware, just an internal data warehouse that our IT department built. But I think they've used that a lot in the past. I will say they're probably starting to use more Starfish data now. I've been collecting kind of, I send out a weekly general Starfish tracking report that has like all the flags, all the kudos, all the to-do items. I send out a general, here's where you are by program, how many are raised, how many are cleared. I think a lot of them use that. And now moving forward, we're implementing Starfish Analytics. So I can see them in the future for next fall really utilizing the Starfish Analytics to get at some of that a lot easier than they have in the past. But yeah, it's any number of things. You asked a question about research and analysis. So yeah, we do. We have a small IR team, but they do look at the intake results for us. And I do some of that as well, kind of some basic, like I mentioned before, how many students responded to the referrals and are they still enrolled, or are they enrolled in the following term or two terms later? So we've done some of that tracking as far as data, but some of the bigger data we have with our IR team and we kind of wait to see. But yeah, we'll share it with whoever needs to share it, whoever wants to see it.
In the beginning, we had quite a bit more IR engagement in looking at sort of multiple factors and then looking at some of our, you know, demographic information and other financial aid information. So they were able to sort of evaluate several other factors from other systems and just start to get a picture of what does an at-risk student look like versus what does a successful student profile look like, and just start getting into, you know, thinking about who our students are. The challenge we have is we just have so much demand for IR time that it would take weeks and weeks for us to get really anything back, and ultimately we'd be on to the next semester and their work would get prioritized. So we would certainly love to see more analysis. You know, are returning adult females succeeding better than transitioning male students right out of high school? You know, those are the kinds of things that we would be able to look at and evaluate and see if there are populations that for whatever reason are telling us that they're worried about being successful that we might be able to connect to.
I want to go way back to early on when you were talking about referrals to different programs. If a student answers all these questions and you're forwarding those referral lists to different areas, is there a possibility the student's going to get 10 phone calls?
Hopefully not. So it is possible that they will get 10 referrals. That is not 10. There's only 8. So 8. It is possible. Okay. But what we've taught the staff, like I said, students don't get notified of those, so they would not get bombarded with 10 emails. But what we've taught the staff is before they make any calls or before they reach out to students, go into the student folder and see what else is out there. And if they can address more than one topic so that you know that you're not getting multiple calls. Now, we will say that we didn't used to do that. So when it was in SurveyMonkey, we did group things and say, if a student has 3 or more, let's go in this order and we won't have them get more than 2 referrals. And again, that took a lot of sorting and a lot of time. And we really found that there wasn't that many students who had more than 3. It was a very small number. So we didn't feel like it was a huge risk moving away from that. And to be honest, since we moved away from that, I haven't counted the number that had more, but I wouldn't anticipate it's a huge percentage. Most of them do just have 2, maybe 3.
For the faculty advising, were there some parameters or criteria that you used to train faculty on the what to, you know, what do you talk about and what you don't talk about to avoid, you know, potential misadvising?
So we put together, and the only reason I guess I even know that much about it, or maybe Kelly would say this too, is that we were involved with this as an IPASS project, but this was really led by learning leadership. But we put together sort of a 3-page document on, you know, the purpose and the intended outcomes and what would be really good content, what would be good questions to ask. I can pretty well assure you that most faculty don't want to talk about anything related to finances or financial aid. It's rare if we ever have a faculty member start, I guess, talking about things that I guess that has come back as a complaint or any sort of concern that we know of, to talk about things sort of outside that scope. For whatever reason, they've been really good, I think, about recognizing their role and the boundaries of that role. And I mean, I can't think of one circumstance that I'm aware of, at least, where a faculty member gave misinformation, because it's really not so much an advising session. I want to be really clear about that. They still have a program advisor assigned to them as a student. This is really about building a relationship with a faculty member who has worked in that field, most likely, who can talk about learning experiences in that field and employers and what a good path might look like. So there's some advising related content, but it's more so about building connections within their program.
And the other thing about the process, whether good or bad, is that there isn't a consistent, here are the things you need to talk about. Each faculty team was able to design their session however they wanted. Now, we gave them suggestions about here's good things to talk about, like John said, but some of them do it during class time and they meet with each student for 5 minutes during class. Some of them require the students to come in after class and make a full half an hour appointment. Some of them have their advisor sit in the room with them and they do it together with their advisor. Some of them don't talk to their advisor at all about it. So it's really not a across the board, here's what faculty mentoring is and here's what it isn't, because it is different depending on the faculty team and program that it is. We're trying to get more consistency with, like John said, with that coaching training. And I think that'll help give a little bit more consistency about what's happening in those conversations, but still how it takes place, whether it's in the classroom, out of classroom time, do they get points for it? Is it extra credit? It varies across the campus.
My colleague and I have been involved in doing the training for Starfish with faculty. just, you know, out of curiosity, we've done in-person trainings that are not very well attended. We've had online video through our professional development portal. Are there any, like, how have you been successful at delivering these trainings? Because I know it's a lot of information. It's new information. It's trying to create a culture where you're getting people to use the tool. What has worked the best for you?
Yeah, so we have a required training for new faculty where they go through a series of trainings. So that's where they get their first Starfish, like 101 is in that required onboarding, the series of trainings. From that point, it's really, all of our staff are required to have 40 hours of professional development every year. So they can pick and choose what that is, but their supervisor a lot of times will suggest certain things or will have certain ones that are required as part of that 40 hours. So sometimes, like John was saying, coaching may be one of those required ones that's included in that. We also just try to keep it front of mind. We have an in-service before each semester, so an in-service before the fall semester and spring semester. So during both of those times, I'm usually invited to go into each department and give a Starfish update about what's new. Here's things you need to remember this semester. Here's functionality that's changed. Remember, you're going to do faculty mentoring, and here's how you do it, and here's how you open the to-do, and here's how you clear it. So I've been fortunate enough to be invited into all of those every semester to kind of keep it top of mind.
Quick question. What is your student population and how many full-time faculty do you have?
So we are about 60% full-time faculty, if not a little bit higher.
What number would that equate to?
Yeah, we have 270 full-time faculty. And in terms of students, we have about 6,000 FTE and probably 13,000 headcount, duplicated headcount, taking credit courses.
And last thing, you were talking about your struggles with the mental health as far as doing a survey. I was curious, at the very end, at the bottom of your survey where you have Kelly's email address, I wonder if you could add a link to a SurveyMonkey, like an optional thing, a mental health questionnaire, fill this out. And just a suggestion, you can play around with it.
Yeah, my contact information is not on the survey in Starfish. That's just for that printed copy that you guys have. And I don't know if Starfish supports links. That is a good suggestion, though, and I'm going to look into it. That's a great idea.
What do you do with your open-ended data? So when you ask them how they're going to succeed in college and they write something, a paragraph, do you read those?
It gives us warm, fuzzy feelings. I don't know. Like, no, just kidding. We do use it for staff members to look at before they have meetings with students, obviously. So it's another one of those case by case. We've also used it just during staff in-services and stuff to kind of have it rolling on a PowerPoint as just motivational. Here's some of the things our students have said. We don't do anything with it widespread. We don't do any analysis of it. It's just kind of there, like John said, to leave the student on a positive note and then for us to use on a case-by-case as we need it. But some of them are very inspirational, I will tell you that. They are amazing to read. So if you ever need a pick-me-up someday, I'll send you some.
The faculty access to that, the survey answers, correct?
Yes.
I have a couple small questions. The coaching framework and the advising guide, are those two different documents? And is it possible for us to see one or both of those?
So from an advising guide, do you mean what we provided faculty around mentoring?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can send that, yeah.
Okay. And then the coaching guide, I'm not sure if this is what you're referring to, but in terms of the way we've trained all of our student services staff in coaching framework?
So those are two separate documents. Is that correct?
Yeah, and the coaching is a little bit different because it's really not one document per se. It's like a whole manual that's proprietary to Inside Track, so that might be a little bit harder. I'm certainly happy to share some of the training that we've been doing in-house, which is really based on Inside Track coaching principles, but we could send along, for example, a presentation of what training might look like in that way.
Would that be of interest to you all? Yeah, that would be terrific. Yeah, we don't want to, and nothing proprietary, but if it's available to share, that would be great. I have one last question since we have just a couple minutes. You've used the word team a lot, and I was intrigued by things that you apply that to student services teams and faculty teams and so forth. Can you share a little bit more about how you organize yourselves by teams and how you work together. It sounds like all of the teams have ongoing work together and they confer with one another and so forth. A little bit more about how you structure yourselves to do this work.
Yeah, I mean, I guess probably the best thing to say about that is we are a team-based culture. And so pretty much everything here is designed around teams. So the college has strategic directions, but teams do their own action planning as it relates to those strategic directions. Teams really do a lot of their own assessment in terms of services with students, track a lot of their own data. And there definitely is an expectation about collaboration. And Intake Survey is a good example of an opportunity to bring teams together and share information more widely and get people working together towards a common end. But that's, I mean, quite honestly, that's been in place since I've been here, because I think it was really fundamental to the approach our president brought when he came here 20 years ago, and he's been here that long, which is probably pretty rare. And so that's how we've always operated. And then when we do training, so even around coaching training, I'll just give you an example. We try to have teams go through training together as much as possible so that when we can customize training to specific roles, there's more opportunity to do that. And so coaching our Welcome Center staff, or I should say training them on coaching when they might only spend 2 to 3 minutes with a student versus an advisor who might spend 45 minutes. We have a coaching training and a coaching light training. And we have teams go through that together so that they're processing that together, they're coming up with ideas together, and then we can also customize the training to some degree to that role, which makes it more meaningful, I think.
Can you give an example of your team? It sounds as if you have a student services team, and who would be on that team?
Sure. So within the student services division, so we have a student services division that has a vice president and 3 deans. And then each of those deans have multiple teams within their areas. So, for example, and I talked about this a little bit earlier, but I have a manager over our counseling and disability services, and I've got Kelly's position, who's managing our early alert work, a manager of academic advising, manager of career services, and then the other teams will look very similar under the other deans, where they have admissions and financial aid and records and support services and student involvement, all of those different areas. And then our leaders from all of those student services meet probably every other month, I want to say, as a leadership group. Our dean's team and our VP meets probably every week on average. So it's a lot of teams in some ways. Mm-hmm. And in some ways it results in a lot of meetings, which can be difficult. But it does provide for a lot of collegiality and support too. So advantages and disadvantages, I guess.
Thank you for setting this up and making the connect. And we really appreciate all of your wisdom that you're generously sharing with us. And we'll try and steal all your good ideas.
No problem.